welcome back to the Gallery Gap, a podcast that examines inequity and equity in museums, exhibitions, collections, and programming. I am Claire. I'm just reading.
Yes, you are. And I'm Melissa. Oh, my goodness. So last week, we heard from Chicago-based artist Jefferson Pinder as he reflected on his exhibition, Ghostlight, which just closed this week at the Figge. If you haven't had a chance to listen to episode 11, we suggest that you go back, have a listen, and then join us here in episode 12, as we're going to be continuing that conversation. So for some of you, we will be here when you get back.
But this week, we pick up where that conversation left off by asking Jefferson to describe the exhibition's multifaceted installation and performance elements.
So you walk into the space, you see three areas of installations and objects and videos in between it. The first area you walk into is a layered platform that Steve Banks calls a ziggurat, and he's a master builder who helped with the process of the whole installation. That is, you know, what you first see. Then you look to the right of that, and you'll see like old CRT television sets with faces on them, of people who just had their hair cut, almost in a Nam June Paik style. They're layered talking heads or quiet heads, actually, they're moving around in space. Then directly opposite that is actually the barbershop installation. And to the left, the ghost light itself, which is a symbol that I'll talk about in a second. And then the conversation, which is it's a platform with a railing on it that's reminiscent of possibly an old, you know, 70s game show or a courtroom. And then there's two stylish 70s chairs that individuals can sit on. And behind those chairs are monitors that have two women, one black, one white, locked into almost like a staring match. And kind of that's the lay of the land of the space. The ghost light idea came to me when I was thinking about how great it is when you walk into a theater at night and you see one solitary light that represents like this experience. And then your mind goes wild thinking about all the different things that could have happened in that space and all the different people that have entered that space. And that light, you know, not only keeps you from falling off the stage, but it also reminds you of a constant, that this active space is continual. That even when you're there in the middle of the night, there is that energy and it doesn't go away. So I wanted to create that for Ghostlight. I wanted to create an installation in which you have these objects that were used in performance, or these installations that were part of performances that happened, but without the presence of a person, that light would be on. And then when people come into that space to perform, the light goes off. So it's a bit of a placeholder for an installation, because as a performing artist, that's something that you grapple with, is like, well, how do you portray performance when there's none there, you know, when it's that empty space? It requires a little bit of imagination, but the light kind of has become symbolic of that experience.
With the ghost light, I know that had earlier iterations as you were pulling this idea together for what the entire exhibition would look like. You've talked a little bit about what is in the space. Do you want to talk about what didn't happen, or what you what had to evolve based on what you did learn about this area?
Yeah. Gosh, you know, I had all these ideas, and then I realized that I live in Chicago. And so what was a blessing, it made me nervous, is that the dependency on the community to help put everything together. From all the individuals, this is a collaborative effort. I mean, when you go into that exhibition, or I guess when a viewer would come into the space, we're used to thinking that there's one person who makes everything. But usually, that doesn't always have to be the case. I think in a contemporary art practice, that a lot of things come together to make a good exhibition. It's like just like if you look at any album and you look at the lead singer, oh, that's great, they have a nice voice. But look at all the different people that help make that happen. It's like I feel like an impresario, but out of practicality, the fact that things needed to be built and I wasn't here. So people like Nancy Solbrig, Tim Guy, Steve Banks were major contributors, as well as Joshua Johnson at the museum, and Andrew Wallace as well, I think, rolled up his sleeves. And I think it became a collaborative effort. So I think this is unique to that regard, that the exhibition kind of relied on the community for its execution. And I'm proud of that. It's nothing to hide about. And I think that it's better because of it. I think it's also great for people in the community to be able to point their finger and say, yeah, I worked on that.
Can we talk about hours for a minute?
Sure.
Like you've spent a significant amount of time in our community, mm-hmm. going all the way back to your very first, or to your first solo video installation. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it took, like what you've put into this yourself? You're Chicago-based, but right. You're also hopping around on other projects. Life, of course, is happening simultaneously, and you're spending significant amounts of time in our community.
Right.
What did it take? You were here for a month in January.
That's right.
And then you were here almost every weekend.
Yeah, every weekend, pretty much. And it was like the most bizarre time, you know, because, I mean, on top of my father passing, I received, a couple awards in this period of time. So it's just like, it's like happy days on one hand, and then it's just like, oh my gosh. And I'm wondering, like, you know, important. I think those moments, you wonder, like, is what you're doing that important? And sometimes I think maybe not, but this case, I thought it was, you know, I was committed to this idea, and I liked coming here. Other than the one-way streets, whose idea was that? Whose crazy idea was those one-way streets? But anyway,
I'm trying to get it fixed, trying to do that differently.
Because it challenged me, you know, it's like, well, how do you get to know a place? Because that is what's the complexity of Davenport. Because you go to the downtown area, you're going to get a very different vibe than you get if you go all the way up Brady to, you know, I guess where all of the shops and the malls are. And that's almost like a completely different culture than you get from the downtown culture. Then you go across the bridge and you get Rock Island and Bettendorf and Moline. I mean, it's just like it's hard to really put your finger on it. It's slippery. And so it required time here. And at first I thought, well, I could do a lot of research online. I can learn about it, find the places to go, where to hit. But, you know, in reality, it was just like it had to be, you know, feet on the ground, you know. And I guess that was demanding. That was a lot more demanding because you want to do a good job. Even if the piece, you know, you never know how successful the work is going to be. I mean, that's the risk. The risk is it could be great, it could be amazing, and sometimes it could fall flat. But the reality is you got to put the time in for it to be successful. And really, it's great to spend time getting to know people. And if you want people to show up for you, you have to be there for them. So I think that was really important to do. I felt like it was a residency of sorts. And it's expensive, you know, and that's why, you know, I just commend the Figgy for putting the time and resources into this project, because it's not cheap to have someone live. I mean, they paid for me to live here for, I think, you know, 2 months at least, and, you know, weekends here and there. So I think but to do something like this right, and it wouldn't be the same if there was someone from in town doing this project. You need someone, a fresh pair of eyes, to come into town and say, wow, like, why are the streets running this way or that way? Or, like, where are the black folks? So, and we found them, you know. Now it's the matter of like, trying to figure out, like, how to get folks to come to the museum that haven't traditionally gone to the museum, and that's a problem that every single museum all across the nation is dealing with right now. It's like, how to bring new people into the museum, or how to take the museum to them. And this project is somewhere in between, I think.
Where does this fall, or where have you situated this in terms of what you've done before and where you hope to go or are already going on other projects?
Like, where does, like, this fit into this practice?
You were doing sculpture, you were doing film. It involved performance. I think of the rowing one. I can't remember what it's called.
Ben-Hur.
Yeah. So, you know, you've done aspects of all of this, but you've pulled it together in a new way here. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, you probably haven't even thought about what happens after, you know.
Actually, I have. And this is important. This show is important for me. I mean, take a look at my body of work, they're black bodies. And I don't know, maybe I had a eureka moment, like, a couple years ago, and I'm like, man, it responds to, this is a dialogue. This isn't a monologue. That somehow there has to be an interaction. I have to start working with white people. And so, you know, and you know, when the whole thing happened with the exhibition, where I had to make some changes, and there were individuals who were ready to go that happened to be white, I was like, well, you know, am I going to want to get the work done, or am I going to try to be specific? And then I realized that it was holding me back a little bit, that I had these ideas in my mind. But part of but it comes from a place from, you know, going to art school, going to a theater program, and always having to work with this idea of whiteness. But but one of the things I'm really excited about is being able to expand and grow, and being able to do black identity work with white bodies. And one of the things that I wrote a proposal for the Guggenheim Foundation, which was about creating a road trip, which started in Florida and toward the southern half of the United States, in which there were stops along the way, in which there would be performances, and I wanted them to be in conservative places. It wasn't enough for me to do my work in museums or in safe places, that I wanted to not only work with different people, but I wanted somehow there to be some growth, that maybe there was something to be learned from conservative, maybe racist or prejudice-leaning people. That somehow that maybe in this last election there hasn't been enough communication with these folks, that there needs to be a connectivity. And so, you know, I think beginning here, you know, and who would have known that Iowa would have gone red? But I mean, that's reality, that there is a community of disenfranchised people who probably were waiting for something different. Well, I wanted to hear from them. I wanted to work with them. I wanted to create work to some degree that was just as much about that experience as it is about mine, and be able to play off those two things. So this road trip, this what I call the Afrofuturist road trip, was about space exploration. You know, it's like, you know, but space exploration into hostile environments. It makes me think about the Freedom Riders, or it makes me think of the Great American Road Trip, you know, Jack Kerouac. It's like it's a romantic idea of being able to travel on the road to make friends, to do work, and to explore kind of like the unknown. So I'm going to be starting in Florida. I'm spending a lot of time in Texas and Arizona, and heading west to California, San Diego. So I've spent very little time in the Southwest, so I'm looking forward to it. So that's going to be the summer of 2018, and I think this has been a prep for that, because it was new territory. It was a little bit of fear of the unknown, and also having to check myself as much as I'm checking into other people. You know what I mean? It's like saying, wait a second, I mean, do I have a bias here? And I think that's what needs to happen. I mean, as an artist, I feel like I have the liberty to be as self-righteous as I want to be. But the truth is that the growth comes with somehow, you know, with, you know, the horrible, evil word that artists are never supposed to use, which is compromise. But I haven't worked on a project in which there hasn't been a compromise. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad word. Rather, it's just like there are certain things that you can, and there's other things that you can't. And the negotiation is probably the most important element of all of it. It's like trying to figure out, like, what are the important things that I can't give up?
Values. Yeah. This is amazing. I look forward to you doing this.
See, I'm really good at the ideas, you know?
Yes, Jefferson.
That's Alfredo Monteco, one of our producers who was in the room while we were talking to Jefferson.
Yeah, yes, Jefferson, sure. How do you protect Jefferson through all this journey as a militant artist?
Yeah.
Which are those boundaries, and how do you protect one to the other?
That's a great question, because I don't know if I'm very good at it, to be honest. I don't know if I'm very good at protecting myself from myself. That's why I rely... I think you get these ideas sometimes, and they're not always... Like this whole road trip idea, I mean, I'm thinking I'm probably not going to get this thing because it sounds like I could get myself killed. You know what I mean? It's like... But you're right. That is one of my biggest things. It's like, well, sometimes when I'm less creative, I find myself like the tennis player running around the tennis court. You know what I mean? When I'm really creative, I can, you know, plant my feet and I can just return the serves. But then when, you know, like when I find myself like drained, then I'm doing a lot more work than I need to. But that's part of the process, I think. In an odd, really masochistic way, I think that's how some of the good work gets done. And I think people like to see a tennis player running around the court, you know. But how do I protect myself from myself? I'm figuring it out. Like I said, today I got a massage and I was like, wow, that was a huge accomplishment. I mean, you know, the idea of like actually like, you know, saying, OK, I'm going to spend this hour and I'm going to relax on a day that I have a lot going on. But I think I rely on my colleagues and friends probably, you know, more than average, because I think the nature of the work is that I at times I lose myself, you know, and I even I'm an emotional person, and sometimes I wish I was more analytical. But I go from the emotion and I try to channel it to something that's more, I guess, linear, and it doesn't always work. So I guess to answer your question, it's something that I'm learning to do, and I think it's going to take a while to be able to not only protect myself, but to be smarter, you know, walking into situations, you know, and to know. But, you know, I think part of the artist's journey is to always change what you do. So it's like every single show is different. And I envy the painters who, you know, are almost like a slow evolution that build, you know, one thing on top of the other, and they can see the evolution. For me, it's like it's jumping from one thing to the next and trying to see if you know, I can find some levity in the moment. There has to be a pressure release, that you got to figure out a way to laugh at some of it, you know, and to not take it so personally when you run into somebody who has really different views from you. And maybe it's not so serious, because out of the, you know, 10 things, maybe 3 things you really don't get along with, but 7 you could connect on. And I think that's probably most important, is try to figure out where the connections are. And try to see if you can work together to be more persuasive and getting them to understand the other 3.
It was such a pleasure speaking with Jefferson. Ghostlight was visually intriguing and incredibly thought-provoking. It provided our community with the time and place for reflecting on race in the Quad Cities, both past and present. And we'll expand on that conversation next week as we go beyond our immediate community and examine the work of Carol Walker and her current Figge exhibition, Emancipation Approximation.
Until then, just a reminder that if you haven't done so already, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play, and you can also listen to the episodes on WVIK's website. There's an email on that website in case you'd like to contact us. And also, don't forget that we include additional information and materials on our Facebook page that relate to the episodes. So if you're interested in digging deeper, be sure to follow us.
And as always, thank you to the Augustana Teaching Museum of Art, the Figge Art Museum, and WVIK for your continued support of this project. A special thanks to our production team, Lacey Scarmana and Alfredo Manteca. And this podcast would still just be a mere idea if it wasn't for the generous sponsorship of Peterson Pates Design. Thank you so much for making this program possible. And last but not least, thank you to all of our listeners. We'll be back next week. You wanted to make a joke about seeing, and I ruined it for you.
I can't handle it. I just have to say, see you soon. This is very tough for me.
Aw.
Aw.
Wah, wah. Wah, wah.